We're really pleased to have a special guest speaker with us. We have Terry Weens with us this morning and giving us our message and continuing part of our series of Adventures in Faith. Many of you likely know Terry. He and his family have been a part of the church for the last 18 years. Terry's also a house church leader as well, so you may have been part of that with him. So we welcome Terry. He works in the finance field, but does have a degree in religious studies and still enjoys digging into theology in his spare time. So we welcome Terry. He always has great insights and will challenge us probably to look at things in a new and fresh way this morning. So I welcome Terry up this morning.
I was sitting in my living room about a week and a half ago. My family was close by, my daughters, Katie and Emily. Katie, I mentioned your name first. That's important, right? Yeah. And Griffin was in the kitchen, and I was sitting in the living room with my wife, Jen, and I was talking about this message that you're going to hear this morning, and talking to Jen about it, and all of a sudden, Griffin pipes up in the kitchen, and he goes, "Dad, what are you talking about?" I'm like, I kind of lean over and look in the kitchen and go, "Griff, I'm doing the message, not this Sunday, but the Sunday after." And he looks at me with this quizzical face, and he's kind of like, "Dad, what are you talking about?" I'm doing the message. And then he said, "Oh, okay, you're doing announcements, Dad. Okay, I get it. All right. I'm like, "No, Griffin, I'm doing the message, you know, like Bill does. I'm doing the message like Bill does." And then all of a sudden, he had this look of fear in his face. I'm like, anyway, so now I've lost my train of thought, and I knew that I would do that. Oh, yes, a little bit of background here. Griffin, when he comes into the service on Sunday mornings, he always grabs himself a tea. He's down there right now. He's drinking his tea. So he's looking at me with this face of fear, and he says, "Dad, on Sunday, I'm going to have to grab two teas." I'm like, "What do you mean you're going to grab two teas? Are you going to be bored or something? You need something else to do?" He's like, "No, Dad, I'm afraid." I'm like, "Why are you afraid? I'm doing the message. Shouldn't I be the one that's afraid?" He goes, "No, Dad." And he's 13 years old. Remember this. He says, "No, Dad, I'm nervous. If you fail, we all fail." I'm like, "Griffin, don't you have any faith in me? Don't you have any confidence?" He never actually answered that question. He's a great kid. I'm glad I'm not embarrassing him too much, I don't think. But speaking of confidence and faith, that's what brings us to our topic of the day. So let's get started. There's a lot of things that can shake our faith or cause us to lose faith or cause us to lose confidence that what we're trusting in is real or reliable. Suffering is one of those things where sometimes we ask God, you know, why did you let this happen to me? Sometimes growing up is something that challenges our faith too. Sometimes our experience as an adult doesn't really match what we learned in Sunday school. Or when we go to college or university, there's things that we learn and they don't seem to match, you know, what we used to read in our Bibles. Another challenge is other solutions. Why do we think that what we believe is anything special or any different? Another thing is guilt. Sometimes guilt can drive us to Jesus for forgiveness, but in other cases, it can drive us from him. You know, sometimes that feeling of inadequacy or that feeling that, you know, God just couldn't forgive me. And my last point here is, and this might sound kind of silly, but I think it's true and I think it's important. Inconvenience. Inconvenience can be a faith killer. We're busy. Sometimes we forget. We slowly stop taking it seriously. You know, we stop hanging out with other believers. We stop going to our small group. We stop doing that daily, you know, focus on Jesus time. And our Christianity slowly becomes a Sunday morning only thing. And we don't do it on purpose. It's just something that slowly fades. So today I'm going to be continuing the series that Bill has been doing the last few weeks. And that's, what did he call it again? Journey? It's not up there. Adventures in Faith, that was it. That's right. And today I'm going to be talking about, the angle I'm going to take is about confidence. Confidence in your faith. If our faith is the real thing, how do we gain confidence? How do we develop a confidence that'll stand the test of time, that'll survive suffering, that'll believe in the face of so many different ideas, that'll continue to trust God even when he's so silent, and a faith that's worth the cost, because there is a cost to following Jesus. So this morning I'm going to talk about three things. I'm going to have 3 points. And just to kind of level expectation here, these three things are not, none of these are quick fixes. You know, we always like quick fixes. I don't know if you ever stay up really late at night and you're flipping through the channels and the infomercials come on, you know, some of those where they'll, you know, they'll promise if you buy our product and you just do this exercise for only 5 minutes a day, for like only 5 weeks, you'll get like rock solid abs or, you know, buns of steel, you know? I think I'm doing pretty good, but my wife keeps telling me that I'm not. I don't know why. Or there's another thing that, you know, another example that's not in any way applicable to me, but maybe some of you guys could use that, you know, the fast-growing hair formulas, you know? You know, that could be helpful. But anyways, nothing, no quick fixes this morning. Some of these things that we're going to talk about, they are learning-related to a degree. They're action-related, some things that you can kind of do, but for the most part, these things are mindset-related. Confident faith is something that takes a journey. It's not a do this and you'll get that. And there's probably other ways in what we're talking about that you can gain confidence in your faith, but these things that I'm going to talk about today are things that have been helpful to me. So this morning, I invite you to take what's useful for you. So we're going to get started with point number one. Confident faith is based on evidence. Now, this might seem counterintuitive to some, because sometimes we think, you know, faith is something not only that we can't see, but we can't prove. And that's how we sometimes define it. And I think we'll find that if we really look at the teachings of Jesus, we find that that's not the kind of faith that Jesus expects of us. That's the kind of faith that our society and our culture, I think, sometimes expects, but not what Jesus does. So I'm going to get started. There was a guy. Is there a bit of an echo there? Should I move a little bit, Chris? A little bit up. Right there. Don't walk around too much. You'll get it. Chris knows what he's doing. There was a guy. He lived a long time ago, one of the first followers of Jesus. And he spent about 3 years with Jesus. And he left his family business to follow Jesus. His name was John. And long after his time with Jesus, probably when he was quite old, he wrote some letters, and some letters to some churches. And these letters are found in our New Testament. And we're going to look at one of the letters, and it's called 1 John. So if you've got your phones, tablets, or books out there, you can turn to 1 John if you want to. Or you can also follow along on the screen behind. My daughter's doing projection today. I'm a father. It's my prerogative to embarrass my kids. I got to take the chance. Anyway, let's go to 1 John chapter 1, verse 1. We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we have heard and seen. So how do we read a verse like this? Well, if you're anything like me, you're reading the Bible because it's the right thing to do. You want to try to get something constructive out of it. You want to be a better follower of Jesus. So you read this verse. You know, there's nothing special really here. Yeah, Jesus existed from the beginning. We know that. The guy who wrote it, John, saw and heard him, been there, kind of done that, right? Like, there's got to be something more inspiring coming, right? I do this kind of thing all the time when I'm reading. I miss the meaning. I understand what he's trying to say, but I don't ask the why question. I don't ask, you know, what's this John guy really trying to get at here? Sometimes we think when we read the Bible that there's got to be some profound spiritual meaning, where in many cases it's common sense, it's down to earth. And in this case, we can really miss the simplicity. What John is starting to talk about here is something that charged up the early church. And even though this was written almost 2,000 years ago, I think maybe it can inspire us and give us confidence today. See, John wrote this quite a while after the life of Jesus, maybe a few decades, probably after Paul wrote most, I think, probably all of his letters that are in our New Testament. Some people were starting to forget after this time. They were starting to wonder, you know, did this all happen? I mean, God coming to earth. That sounds pretty unbelievable. Jesus rising from the dead. Nobody rises from the dead. It's so unbelievable. And 40, maybe 50 years later, people are starting to think, huh, did somebody just make this all up? You know, when you tell a story and then someone tells somebody else and they tell somebody else and it just keeps going, and by the time you get to the end, the story is completely different than what you heard at first. Like, is that what happened here? Is this a stretched story? Is this maybe something that's just become a legend or even a myth? Okay, we're talking 40 to 50 years after the life of Jesus here. Here we are, almost 2,000 years later. So I'm thinking, maybe this passage that we're going to read through here, maybe it's even more applicable to us than it was for John's original audience. This is exciting stuff. So let's read this again. And this time, let's try to read it like we're reading it for the first time. We proclaim to you the one who existed from the beginning, whom we have heard and seen. Now, wait a minute, John. Are you saying that you heard and saw this? Like that you were there, that you were an eyewitness, that this isn't just some kind of teaching that was handed down to you? You're saying you were there? Yeah, and he's not just saying that. He's saying we, meaning there was other people when he wrote this that knew Jesus, that had seen him, that would say, yeah, John, you're right. I was there too. That's what happened. Are we getting the right picture here? Like, is this what John's actually trying to emphasize? Is he trying to tell us that he was an eyewitness? Let's read on. We saw him with our own eyes and touched him with our own hands. See, I'm thinking the legend and myth theory doesn't quite work here. He's saying they hadn't just heard and seen with their own eyes, with their own hands. He is the word of life. This one who is life itself was revealed to us, and we have seen him. And now we testify and proclaim to you that he is the one who is eternal life. He was with the Father, and then he was revealed to us. We proclaim to you what we ourselves have actually seen and heard. And why? He continues, so that you may have fellowship with us, and our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We're writing these things so that you may fully share in our joy. And what is that joy? It's the joy of knowing firsthand from someone trustworthy who was there. The confidence of knowing that this wasn't just a teaching that was handed over, or some philosophy, or some way of living, or some religion. They actually saw him with their own eyes, heard him with their own ears, and touched him with their own hands. This is what makes following Jesus different from every other faith and religion. You're not just being asked to follow a way of life, or a philosophy, or a teaching that's been handed down. Being a Christian, according to its founder, Jesus, is not about religion. And I'm not saying this morning that religion is a bad thing, but it's not about religion. It's about following a person. A person who people saw and heard and touched both before and after he died. So we can be confident because of eyewitness testimony. So how can we be certain we can trust them? How do we know they didn't just make it all up? Here's one very convincing reason. Almost all of them were killed. Now, some people may be willing to die for what they believe in, but just because you're willing to die for what you believe in, it doesn't make it true. And here's one tragic example. The World Trade Towers, they were destroyed by people who died for what they believed in. But the earliest followers of Jesus, and I think this is so important, the earliest followers of Jesus did not die for what they believed in. They didn't die for some philosophy or some teaching. They died for what they themselves saw, heard, and touched. Some people might be crazy enough to die for what they believe in, but nobody's crazy enough to die for a lie. This is what charged the early church. This is what made them so fearless. This is why Christianity spread so quickly in the early days. They knew the truth because they'd seen it. And even those who hadn't, they knew people who had known Jesus. We can have confident faith. On to point number two. Confident faith is other-centered. Here we're going to consider the teachings of Jesus. We find something very unique in Jesus' teachings. And I'm going to mention this because it can be a real faith builder, but it can also be a real challenge. It can be very difficult. It can even maybe chase us away from Jesus. Before I get into it, let me ask you this one question. What is, from what we know of Jesus in the New Testament, what are the two most important commandments? This is the interactive point. Emily told me not to do that, but here. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself, right? This is what summarizes the whole Bible, according to Jesus. It doesn't sound that difficult. You know, love your buddies. Love the person that's next door, right? That's who our neighbor is, literally, in our society, right? Love the person who sits next to you at work. Love the person who's sitting beside you right now at church today. Sounds pretty comfortable. But then with Jesus, there's a twist. There's a challenge to this. Something that even in extreme cases could even offend us. So let's figure out what Jesus really means here. Here we go. There was a guy. Another guy. This one's not a disciple of Jesus. This guy, he's a teacher of the law. He's a leader, someone who was highly respected by the people of Israel at the time. He taught people about the law, and he taught people how to follow God. He came up to Jesus one day when Jesus was teaching about loving your neighbor as yourself, and he thought he had his act together. He thought Jesus was going to commend him. So he comes up to Jesus and says, "So Jesus, who is my neighbor?" And he was thinking, Jesus is going to say, you know, the people that I'm serving and helping out here, people close to me, my own fellow Israelites. He thought Jesus would say, "Good job, great work." But instead, Jesus told a story. And most of us probably know what this story is. It's the parable of the Good Samaritan. So what Jesus does to explain who a neighbor is, he uses the example of a Samaritan. Now, the term Good Samaritan is actually not found in our Bibles. I mean, when you look, you'll see it on the title of the section probably, but that's not what the author actually wrote. And the reason is because there's no such thing as a Good Samaritan. The people of Israel at the time, they didn't like the Samaritans. In fact, the Samaritans were people who had betrayed their nation. They had betrayed God. The people of Israel despised the Samaritans. They hated the Samaritans. So what's Jesus doing here? He's giving the example of our neighbor as the Samaritan. What he's saying is, he's telling us that our neighbor is actually the person we can't stand. It's the person whose beliefs offend us, the person we hate. It's our enemy that Jesus is telling us to love. You see, for Jesus, love is not something comfortable. It's not something we do for somebody we like. Anyone can love somebody they like. For Jesus, love is something that costs us. You see, Jesus ups the bar here. So there's this concept of compassion that every faith and religion, almost every faith and religion, supports, as they should, because it's a fantastic moral concept. But Jesus goes way farther than that. He makes it way more challenging. I mean, how can I be expected to love somebody that that I fundamentally disagree with, or who offends me, or even someone who hurts me. How do you love somebody like that? And when Jesus is saying love, he's not talking about nice feelings. He's talking about giving something up for that person. He's talking about sacrifice. He's talking about me giving up something for someone that I hate. This brings me to a story from a long time ago. Okay, not that long ago. I was in grade 12, or it wasn't that long ago. Actually, it might have been grade 13. Okay, that kind of dates me, I think. Grade 13. Actually, grade 13, I was actually in the year where the first year that grade 13 ceased to exist. They called it OAC. But anyways, everyone still went for a fifth year at the time, and a lot of people still do now. But anyways, and I don't know which grade it was, but me, my bus, because I used to bus to school, it was probably the last bus that came at the end of the day. So I would be sitting in the cafeteria waiting for my bus to come, because it'd be the last one, and I'd be sitting there with some friends. And one day, when I was sitting in the cafeteria waiting for my bus, chatting with my friends, this guy came in the cafeteria. Everybody knew this guy. He didn't usually come in at the end. I don't know why he was there. I don't remember. Regardless, he came in. You got to understand something. Nobody liked this guy. Like, nobody. Everybody bugged this guy and teased this guy. And there was good reason why. This guy, he wasn't just annoying. He was really annoying. Anyway, so I saw this guy, and I'm actually ashamed of this. I got up and I went over there and I teased him. I started giving him a hard time. I started saying things to him that had hurt his feelings, that everyone could hear. Everyone laughed along. Why did I do that? I don't know. It's what everybody else did. Maybe it made me look cool. So when I was done doing that stupid thing, I went back, sat down with my friends. They were laughing. We're talking. And then this girl came up to me. We weren't friends or anything. In fact, it's someone that I probably didn't get along that well with, but she came up to me. She looked me in the face and she said, "Terry, I know you're a Christian. And you know what? I've been thinking about it. But now that I saw this, I want nothing to do with it." I had an opportunity to show the love of Jesus to someone who could have really used it. I got to speak up, sorry. I had an opportunity to show the love of Jesus to someone who really, really needed it. And not only that, I had the opportunity to show an example of following Jesus to somebody else. And I messed it up. I really messed it up. The greatest example of love is Jesus going to the cross. And he died for everyone. No matter how they treated him. No matter what their beliefs were. No matter how good or bad they were. It made no difference. He died for everyone. And he loved them. He even loved the people who were killing him. So when Jesus asks us to love our neighbor, he's asking us to love all people, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done, no matter whether they're annoying or not, even no matter how they've treated us. He asks us to love everyone. And one more point I want to make about this point. Jesus did not promise, like some churches today, and I don't know why, are proclaiming that if you follow Jesus, he's going to fill you with material blessings. He taught us to sacrifice. He taught us that in this world, we'd have trouble. So when we suffer for what we believe, which I don't think happens that much in our society, or even when we suffer for no particular reason, Jesus told us that that would happen. And followers of Jesus should not be surprised. We are promised We are promised that it'll be worth it, that we can be part of the mission, that we can be part of what Jesus is doing here on earth right now. But we're not promised a trouble-free life. Confident faith, a confident trust in Jesus, understands that sacrifice and sometimes suffering is part of the plan. On to my last point. This might be the most important one. A confident faith, a confident trust in Jesus, is a trust that constantly focuses on him. And there's a lot of practical ways that we can focus on Jesus. You know, you can go for a quiet walk and pray. I used to go to a coffee shop and I'd bring my tablet and I'd pull up my Bible app and just read. It's important to regularly look at the teachings of Jesus, to regularly spend that quiet time. It's so important. I forget this so often. And this reminds me of two stories in the New Testament that clearly illustrate what we're talking about here. And the first one is one that actually came up in our church within the last couple months. It was actually Josh, our new pastor, who's starting soon. He started this. He talked about this. And I'm just going to review it because it's so important for my point here. It's about a time when Jesus was invited over to someone's house for a big dinner. It was the house of two sisters, Mary and Martha. So let's read the story, see what happens. As Jesus and the disciples continued on their way to Jerusalem, they came to a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Her sister Mary sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing. She came to Jesus and said, "Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me." But the Lord said to her, and I like this, Jesus isn't always gentle when he speaks. Here with his friend Martha, he's being really gentle. "My dear Martha, you're worried and upset over all these details. There's only one thing worth being concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and it will not be taken away from her." There's so many important things in life. Making the big dinner, that's important. You know, going to work, feeding your family, making a living, driving your kids to hockey practice, doing your homework. Are my kids still listening? You guys still awake? Just checking. Making sure that your lawn is at least as green as the neighbor's. There's a lot of important stuff. But let's remember what's most important. Sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening. On to my last example. And on this example, we're going to wrap everything up. Peter. Peter's one of my favorite characters in the Bible. Peter messes up so much. That's why I like him. You know, there's so many times when Jesus says, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Often Peter was the recipient of those words. And if he wasn't the only one, he was with the disciples that received it. And there's so many examples where Peter screwed up. I could list tons of them. I'm just going to highlight a few just because it's important to understand my last illustration, to understand how much this guy messed up. A few examples. There was one where Jesus had just done this incredible miracle, where he took some leftovers and fed well over 5,000 people. It was incredible. And then after this miracle happened, he sent his disciples across the lake in a boat. And a little after that, he followed them, and he's walking on the water. We sung about walking on the water today. And Jesus is walking on the water, and when the disciples are looking, and they say, "Hey, that's Jesus," Peter, in the boat, he's always the first one to speak up. He always talks without thinking. He says, "Jesus, if it's you, tell me to come walk on the water." I wonder if he regretted that. I also wonder what Jesus was thinking. Like, what are you talking about, buddy? I don't know. But Jesus said, "Okay, come." So Peter jumps out of the boat, and he's walking on the water towards Jesus, probably just thinking, "Wow, this is amazing." And then he hears the wind, because it was a little stormy out. And then he sees the waves, and he gets scared. And he starts to sink. And he cries out to Jesus for help, and immediately Jesus reaches out and helps him. And you hear the line, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Peter probably thought, oh, I screwed up, and right after that big miracle, I wonder if he was thinking there, I hope I get another chance. And he's going to. But before we go to that, another mess up. And this one, this is a big one. Jesus is telling his disciples that he's going to be handed over to the authorities, that he's going to be beaten and abused and killed, and then on the third day, he's going to be raised to life. Peter didn't like this. Peter disagreed with Jesus. He thought, this isn't the mission. This isn't it. He thought that Jesus was there to rescue the Israelites from their Roman oppressors. He wanted Jesus to declare himself king of a new and free nation. He rebuked Jesus. He's like, no, Jesus, this isn't the way it's going to happen. And then Jesus turns to him and says, get behind me, Satan. Imagine that, being called Satan by Jesus. That's crazy. That's a lot worse than you of little faith. You'd think it can't get any worse than that, but it does. See, near the end, Jesus is telling his disciples that one of them is going to betray him. And then Peter, in his typical fashion, speaks before thinking. He goes, not me, Lord. It doesn't matter if everybody abandons you. I never will. Some of us know the story. Jesus tells him, actually, yeah, you will. And you're going to do it three times. And that's exactly what happens near the end, right before Jesus goes to the cross, when he probably needed Peter there the most. Peter disowns him three times. So let's go to the last story in the Gospel of John. And this happens after Jesus has been risen from the dead. He's standing on the shore of the lake, and his disciples are fishing. Let's read the story. Later, Jesus appeared again to the disciples beside the Sea of Galilee. This is how it happened. Several of the disciples were there. Simon Peter, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, the two other disciples. Simon Peter said, I'm going fishing. We'll come too, they all said. So they went into the boat, but they caught nothing all night. At dawn, Jesus was standing on the beach, but the disciples couldn't see who he was. He called out, fellows, have you caught any fish? No, they replied. Then he said, throw out your net on the right side of the boat, and you'll get some. So they did, and they couldn't haul in the net because there were so many fish in it. Then the disciple Jesus loved said to Peter, it's the Lord. When Peter heard that it was the Lord, we're going to stop right there. Let's put ourselves in Peter's shoes right now. I'm going to put myself in Peter's shoes. Here I am on the boat. I've just found out that Jesus is there on the shore. He's there wanting to be with his disciples again. A lot of stuff's cleared up. You know, Jesus is who he said he was. He rose from the dead. There's no more doubt. But if I'm Peter, there's something in the way. See, I'm a big screw-up. I'm the worst of the disciples. I'm like Judas. I betrayed him three times, even when he said I was going to do it. Here's how the story goes for me. Then the disciple Jesus loved said to me, it's the Lord. When I heard that it was the Lord, I was filled with shame. I sank down in the boat, ducked my head down so Jesus wouldn't see me. Maybe Jesus won't stay too long. Maybe he won't notice me. But the disciples rowed to shore, and I stayed in the boat, telling them, you know, go ahead, be with Jesus. I'll just stay here and clean the nets. We caught a lot of fish, you know. I hope he doesn't come over to the boats. I just hope he doesn't. I don't deserve to be his disciple. I betrayed him. I tried to take him away from his mission. I'm selfish. I'm a coward. I kept disappointing him over and over again. I'm not good enough. Peter had every reason to hide in shame. But let's look at what really happened in the story. Let's read it. Then the disciple Jesus loved said to Peter, "It's the Lord." When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his tunic, for he had stripped for work. Sorry, that's a little distracting. Makes you wonder, what were these guys wearing when they were fishing? But anyways, let's focus. Too descriptive, John. Keep that out. Anyway, he put on his tunic, jumped into the water, and headed to shore. The others stayed with the boat and pulled the loaded net to shore, for they were only about 100 yards from the shore. When Peter saw Jesus, he had only one focus. Like a little kid, he saw the person, the one person that he loved more than anyone or anything else in the world, and he just jumped into the water. What about the wind and the waves? Remember last time? He doesn't care. All that matters is Jesus. He's just focused on Jesus. Drowning didn't matter. I don't know if he could swim or not. Looking stupid didn't matter. Even helping his friends bring the boat to shore didn't matter. He just trusts Jesus. He just wants Jesus. It's a leap of faith. But it's not a leap of faith in ignorance. The power of Jesus had been proven. It's no longer a barrier to him. His own shame and betrayal and selfishness, those things could have been a barrier. But they're not for Peter. He's just excited that Jesus is there. All he wants is to be with Jesus. There's nothing wrong with being excited and emotional. Some of us are afraid of that. I'm kind of afraid of that. But we need more of that. But it's a lot bigger than that. You know, we need an inner enthusiasm, a growing, long-term excitement, not something temporary, not an adrenaline rush. We need a confident, unwavering passion that's not shaken by the storm. It's not hindered by shame. It's not afraid because of our own mess-ups and failures. We need a passionate faith that's based on history, based on revolutionary teaching, focused on Jesus, and concerned and helping those around us. In conclusion, a confident faith is based on evidence. Our faith is rooted in history, on a specific historical event that people gave their lives to proclaim. A confident faith must be other-centered. That's what Jesus calls us to be. And to have a confident faith, to confidently trust in Jesus, we have to focus on him. We've got to take the time. So I'm going to leave you guys with, and myself, a challenge for this week. Two questions. If you answer both, bonus points. And those questions are, how will you sit at the feet of Jesus and listen? And or, how will you jump out of the boat? Let's pray. God, help us to trust you more. Remind us, Jesus, of your life, your death, your resurrection. Help us to see how real this is. Help us to read your teachings like your early followers did. Help us to be excited and passionate about them and passionate about following you. Give us a confident faith that loves others and focuses intently.